Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, where we're asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is August 21st, 2015. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher, Bruce Rawls. Now, on today's show, we're going to be discussing a section from the ACIM textbook, Chapter 20, Section 7, that's titled The Consistency of Means and End. And I will admit, when I first saw that, Bruce suggested this, I'm like, okay, what the heck does that mean? He's going to have to explain it to me. But then, of course, once I started reading, I'm like, oh yes, I remember this part of the textbook. But I know that that sounds like, you know, what the heck are they talking about? But don't have any fear, because Bruce is going to talk us through this section of Chapter 20. And while you're listening today, please join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook. And if you are new to the show, welcome. Thanks for finding us this morning. And one of the easiest ways to find that group page on Facebook is actually to go to our website, 12radio.com, and you're going to see a chat button. Go ahead and click that, and it will literally automatically put you onto Facebook, where you can ask to join our group. And that guy at the door ready to let you in is our producer, Scott Weaver. And Scott, thanks for being here today. So let's just get on and let's talk about this exciting part of Chapter 20. Welcome, Bruce.
Thanks, CA. Thanks for having me on the show again.
Hey, you are welcome. And truly, when I saw that, I'm like, the consistency of means and end? What?
Huh?
But, you know, like I said, once I started reading, I go, okay, yeah, I remember. But it does remind me sometimes how important it is not to take certain things out of context.
Right.
Because, you know, I, for one, love to quote. You know, I just love to throw quotes around or things that I've picked up. Uh-huh. But when you throw around something like that, somebody go, what the heck are you talking about? And so when it comes to the course, you know, you really do need to listen to the context to really understand the meaning of it. And I think most people, once they start reading this, if they're familiar at all with the course, are going to go, okay, yep, I get it. I get where he's going here. So anyway, thank you for the suggestion. It's a great part of the text.
It is. It is. And as we were chatting a few minutes before we started the recording, I was commenting that it seems like the real quick Cliff Notes distilled version could be, you know, in order to have peace, you got to practice forgiveness. And I think that's, you know, perhaps an oversimplification, but the course really is very simple. And it does address the idea that in order for us to really, really, you know, let go of, and it's not a one-shot deal, obviously, it takes a lot of practice, let go of our attachment to lack of peace, or our resistance to peace, if you will, we need to employ the means in order to get to that end. And the means that the course is all about is, it's always addressing the mind, number one. And number two, it's the what it wants us to address in our minds is the idea that we have made up a tiny mad idea, and we can forgive ourselves for having believed that it was possible. And so that, I think that's kind of that wasn't really as short as I thought it was going to be, but that's kind of what I've been getting out of it now that I've reread it. You know, when you said never fear, I was thinking, well, that's how we get rid of our fear. Actually, that's how we, you know, and why I, you know, find it helpful to go through this is because I look at the stuff that comes up for me and the fears that come up in my mind, and those are addressed by when I'm willing to look at the you know, where I'm discrepant, as that first paragraph says, where I'm not willing to bridge the gap between the means and the end, you know, where I'm saying, well, yeah, I want to be peaceful, but I don't want to do the work, you know.
Right. Well, and interestingly enough, as luck would have it, I don't know what brought you or prompted you to kind of look at this part of the textbook. You can explain that if you want. But interestingly enough, I was with a client and saying almost this exact thing. I mean, we were talking about the ideas that we often say, oh, I want this, I want this, I want this. But do we really want it? Because the minute somebody says, oh, this is what it's going to cost, or this is what it takes to get it, it may not be that difficult, but we go, oh, I guess I didn't really want that. And, you know, we do need to close that gap. And instead of, the way I put it to her, instead of bitching and moaning about why we don't have blah, 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 or why that isn't our life experience, why don't we just look at the fact that this is the cost, this is the strategy. Do you want the goal enough to follow the strategy or not? But don't believe that somebody's just going to hand it to you. And, you know, in this section, he even says, this is pretty simple. You know, we're not really asking a lot of you. It's pretty simple. But if you say you really want this goal, like you said, if you want peace, then you have to practice forgiveness. That's the strategy. That's the way you're going to get it.
That's it, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So it is simple. You can boil it down pretty simply.
I think so. And how about if we just read that first paragraph? Because I think there's a lot in there. It starts out, it says, we have said much about discrepancies of means and end and how these must be brought in line before your holy relationship can bring you only joy. And then the holy relationship, of course, that's being talked about is the relationship that we have with the right mind, or what the Course calls, the Jesus of the Course, or the Holy Spirit, which is really the remembrance that we took with us into the dream that said nothing happened.
Right.
We're really off the hook here, but we're so incredibly talented and skillful, and our mind is so powerful. We've made up this elaborate, holographic, multidimensional scenario, you know, with special effects, you know, putting to shame anything that the best Hollywood studios can come up with. But it's so convincing that we think this is the real deal. And because of that, you know, we've invested heavily in it. I mean, our whole portfolio of our thoughts, if you will, is invested in this fantastic, unbelievable dream scenario that we call space-time and bodies and galaxies and planets and people and and molecules and atoms. Since we were talking about the
protons
physics and the chemistry.
Whatever they are.
Yeah.
Neutrons? Is that what they are?
Yeah, neurons and neutrons. Yeah,
electrons, whatever.
Yeah. But it's an incredibly elaborate system that we've set up as a resistance plan, as a means to not achieving the goal that A Course in Miracles suggests is what we really want, and which is really a peace that can't be possibly shaken. And that's one that takes practice. And another thing that I think comes to mind is that the results that we're looking for, the end, if you will, that the Course is talking about, has nothing to do with form or behavior or outcomes in the world. And it's certainly one of the more challenging ideas in the Course is, you know, the statement says there is no world. This is the central thought that the Course attempts to teach. So if that's true, then what is it there in the world that we're trying to achieve? and obviously, so if that's the case, then it must be a mental state and a way of looking at the world and not a change in the world that we're trying to affect an outcome in. So given that premise, then it starts to make sense. And I think that's can be really helpful for people who've been studying the Course for a while to go back. And this is, you know, kind of one of those aha moments when listening to one of Ken Wapnick's tapes not too many months ago, where he said, you know, that you can recognize you're starting to understand and, you know, making progress with the Course is when you recognize that it's addressing the mind and not the specific person that we think we are.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that this the I'm fortunate because I have a name that rhymes in a very punny way with a nickname I like to call myself when I'm more lucid, which is Bruce-a-fiction. And so if I can remember that this character that, you know, I respond to when someone says, hey, you, you know, usually with that name appended to it, that is a made-up idea. It's a made-up concept. But we're so indoctrinated, self-indoctrinated in responding to that and reacting to it that we think that's the real deal. But the idea, the essence, the spirit that is being addressed throughout these 1300 whatever pages is really the beyond the persona, and you know, it's more than transpersonal. It's really outside of space and time altogether. This awareness that says, yeah, I am the same awareness that we all have and all are, that isn't subject to the world, isn't subject to what happens or doesn't happen. And sure, we, you know, we might have preferences that things happen a certain way in the world, but if it doesn't, if it's not, if it's kind of a sort of a don't care, in the sense of not allowing it to affect our peace of mind, then we have, in those moments, achieved a state of independence that I think the Course suggests. Not that we would become immune to feeling, and it doesn't. I don't think the Course suggests at all that we become insensitive or in the least way unkind or uncaring in terms of how we relate to each other, but in terms of having something impact us in a way that immobilizes us and you know brings us to our knees in the mental sense, to where we're no longer able to do what we can do. I think that's what it's talking about. So anyway, and then it goes on and says, but we have also said that the means to meet the Holy Spirit's goal will come from the same source as does his purpose. And being so simple and direct, this Course has nothing in it that is not consistent. And again, it's consistent in content, but not necessarily in form. I think that's an important thing because the language can be all over the map, but if the meaning behind the words, which is kind of like, you know, when you, I like to think of it when you talk to a dog or a cat, you know, or to an animal, the words aren't important, but it's the tone behind them. It's the feeling, the meaning. I mean, you could say, you stupid animal, you know, but if you, but if what you really, what was being conveyed is I love you, you know, and you know, the animal, the pet, whatever, is going to pick up on the tone. And so it's sort of analogous to, not that we would want to call our animal stupid, but, you know, I think it's really the importance is, you know, what is the intention, the feeling behind, and usually the words are going to match that, of course. But anyway, I think that's an important thing, too, is that the content is really what's being addressed and not necessarily the form.
Right, which goes right back to taking things out of context too.
Yes.
You know, we want to take some beautiful flowery, I mean, and I do it, I'm guilty. You know, I want to take some beautiful flowery phrase right out of it, but I need to go right back and go, but CA, you know, are you really keeping consistent with the context here?
Yeah.
You know, was this just an analogy versus you're taking it very literally?
When you said beautiful flower, and before you finished the word and added phrase to it, I was thinking, you know, plucking a flower out of a meadow, you know, it's like, it's,
yes,
you
yes.
know, there's, and you, we're talking about aroma and that particular sensory mechanism. And I was thinking, well, once you remove something from its context, then the fragrance begins to fade, you know, the quality of wholeness and completion begins to diminish the instant we take it out of the context. And the whole idea, I think, of this non-dual teaching is that when we take our individuality as important relative to the wholeness that we are in terms of our relationships with each other and as one being ultimately, that, you know, basically removes the context and removes the content, because out of context, out of content, the self, the little self that we think we are is really infinitesimal. It's subatomic.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like that analogy too, because it kind of goes right back to, like you said, plucking the flower. Once you're disconnected from the context, once you're disconnected from the source, mm-hmm. how quickly does the flower fade?
Yeah.
You know, the flower just doesn't exist, you know, outside of being connected to the source.
Right, right. And the roots, metaphorically in this case, is our connection to that inner kindness teacher, that awareness that says, yeah, there is a different way of being in the world. There is a different way of looking at everything that seems to happen to us. And that way of looking is to see that it's a forgiveness classroom and an opportunity to look at everything that crosses our path. You know, or as Gary Renard's teacher say, you know, whatever's up in front of your face on a given day, you know, that's your forgiveness classroom. And that's I think, incredibly empowering to see that it is doable, to look at everything that happens to us, as Freud said, you know, that dreams are the royal road, you know, to the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And A Course in Miracles adds the idea that, you know, all our time is spent in dreaming, and that our nighttime dreams and our waking dreams are the same, just different in form. But to the extent that we were dreaming of separation, we're asleep. But we can use the specifics of the dream, the feedback, as the means. The lesson in our classroom at any given moment is whatever's in front of my face, whatever particularly I may be annoyed or irritated or upset with, not for the reason I think,
mm-hmm.
and see that upset is exactly what I needed to look at in my unconscious mind, which I can never see directly because it's unconscious, but I can look at it from the mirrored reflection that it provides to see what I need to forgive about myself. And it takes the form of some other person or persons or some situation or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'll just finish this paragraph real quick.
Uh-huh.
The seeming inconsistencies or parts you find more difficult than others are merely indications of areas where the means and ends are still discrepant. So in other words, we're selective. We kind of like, oh, well, yeah, maybe I'll try this, and then maybe I won't sometimes, and sometimes others. You know, we're kind of intermittent in practice. And so we get intermittent results. You know, it goes to reason, doesn't it? And this produces great discomfort. This need not be. And then it says, this course requires almost nothing of you. That could be really discouraging.
Yeah.
if you take it from where we normally think we are, you know, because obviously it starts out saying that, all that's necessary is a little willingness. And then later on in the course, it says what's needed is an abundant willingness. Well, fortunately, we have, you know, an opportunity over time to develop that abundant willingness. And then the last sentence is, it is impossible to imagine one that asks so little or could offer more. And the little is really asking, the means that is being asked for is for us to not to give up our egos and just say, oh, I'm going to deny that it exists, or to fight it and stave it off and you know, tooth and nail kind of thing. But just to look at it, just to see, is this getting me the results I want?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and total honesty, and just say, when I get upset with someone, when I fly off the handle, you know, verbally or just inwardly, you know, it doesn't even have to be manifested in where anyone could notice. Does that give me the quality of mind that I'm looking for? And in all honesty, if we look at the moments when we are, you know, upset with someone else, it really just basically is saying, I want to be upset with myself a little while longer. Thank you very much. Doesn't it?
Yes.
And it sounds silly, but that really is. I mean, I think the course, I think, is a brilliant document in pointing out where we're masochistic.
Yes,
it is. And just say, not in any kind of condemning way, just say, can you look at your masochism? Can you look at your habit of self-abuse, and you're reveling in it, and you're savoring it, and say, maybe this isn't quite what you really could be in your best interest, you know?
Right. And this next paragraph, in fact, I love, like, especially the second half of the next paragraph. So I'm going to read it. It says, okay. You recognize you want the goal. Are you also not willing to accept the means? Mm-hmm. If you're not, let us admit that you are inconsistent.
Right.
You know, I mean, there again, I just love how blatant it is. It's not that this is inconsistent. You're inconsistent.
Right.
And then it says, a purpose is attained by means. And if you want a purpose, you must be willing to want the means as well. How can one be sincere and say, I want this above all else, and yet I do not want to learn the means to get it?
Pretty obvious, huh?
Yes. I mean, you know, it's kind of where we were going in the beginning. It's like, okay, if this is important, if this is a priority, then how can you not go after it? That's where the gap appears,
yeah.
You know, where we think, you know, we're on one side and what we want is on the other side, when the bridge is right there.
Right. Exactly. And I think it's super important to be willing to be kind to ourselves when we notice the resistance. When we say, yeah, okay, I'm resistant right now, but I'm at least willing to admit that, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to beat myself up because I'm not ready for that level of peace or that kind of awareness where my innocence is uncompromised.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That,
yeah. In fact, I was kind of thinking this is an old story, but my sister and I, years and years ago, we were traveling somewhere and something was going on in the family that was really upsetting us.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, as soon as we got together, she was in one state, I was in another state. And so as soon as we got together, you know, like we met at the airport or whatever it was, you know, we kind of started in on it. And I looked at her and I said, I'll tell you what, I don't want to spend my whole weekend doing this. And I said, so how about if we say we're going to talk about this for 30 minutes and then we're going to let it go? And so it was kind of that same kind of thing of, we know this doesn't make us feel good. We know this isn't where we want to be. This is not how we want to spend our time, but we got to do it anyway. You know, we've got to allow ourselves to just say our piece.
Right.
And so that's what we did for 30 minutes. We just like boom, 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 boom. And it's like, okay, it's done. We're not talking about that the rest of the weekend. You know?
All that venom was spent and gone.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I think putting, you know, a limit on it and just saying, you know, I can see where this is going and be willing to you know, enact a certain mental discipline to just say, is this really, you know, getting me where I want to go? And well, and sometimes maybe we're not willing to admit that, but that's okay. And just say, all right, I want to thrash around this for a while longer. That's okay.
Right. I want to get dirty. I want to get in the mud and, you know, but like you said, just when we're aware of it, what a big difference.
Yes.
Because then we're not a victim to it. We're just saying, okay, I know there's another way,
yeah.
But right now I just need to be here. I just need to do this, but my awareness will help me later make that other choice. I mean, it's remembering that we're decision makers.
Exactly. And I think that mindfulness while we're choosing for the ego is really part of undoing it, because it basically we're invoking that observer awareness and saying I'm maybe not willing to get rid of my upset and to my belief that there's something outside of me that's upsetting me and go down that road, so to speak. But while I'm doing this, like chewing gum and walking at the same time, I'm able to notice, you know, the thought process and watch it. And the very fact that we're watching it basically, in a sense, distances us, I think, from that crazy thought system,
mm-hmm.
and gives us a little bit more clout, a little more purchase, as my grandpa used to say when he was teaching me how to hammer nails as a kid.
Yeah.
I like that word, a little purchase. You know, you need more purchase on that tool. So it's you know, we've got a little bit more to go on to the next time it comes around to say, oh yeah, and I don't have to drag it. Maybe like in your example with your sister, maybe the next time you'll limit it to 29 minutes or
right.
or even 22 or something. You know, it's like, oh yeah, yeah. Well, I think we got through this a little quicker this time. You know, kind of thing.
No, that's right. We threw our temper tantrum and now it's over.
Yeah, the tantrum timer.
Mm-hmm. There you go. I like that.
Yeah, actually, that kind of fits in with an indigenous practice that I'm not sure if it's correct. It's, you know, hearsay, but I thought it was kind of a cool story. Is that apparently in some Native American tradition, well, it was Navajo or Hopi or something like that, they basically give someone, you know, three times to tell their story to the tribe, and after the third time, everybody just, you know, looks the other way or turns a deaf ear kind of thing. And in other words, if you haven't resolved it in three utterances, three storytellings, then it's like, okay, we've heard this enough, you know, next.
You know that I like that. Thank you for sharing that. Cause I have a couple of soapbox issues,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, sometimes I get to that point and I go, see, hey, that's 20 years ago. How long are you going to tell that story? And so I kind of needed to hear that, Bruce. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Well, I think there's, you know, wisdom everywhere we look and you know, the willingness to notice our grievances and to, you know, not to try to brute force them to the ground, you know, in a big wrestling match in the mind, but just to watch them and see, well, where is this getting me, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. Well, the very next paragraph also has some great stuff. How about if I jump into that. It
Yeah.
says to obtain the goal, the Holy Spirit indeed asks little. He asks no more to give the means as well. The means are second to the goal, and when you hesitate, it is because the purpose frightens you, not the means. Remember this, for otherwise you will make the error of believing the means are difficult. Yet how can they be difficult if they are merely given you? And the means given us, if the means of peace is to forgive ourselves for our projections, and the forgiveness comes from listening to that inner kindness teacher and saying, oh, yeah, I guess I don't have to make such a big deal about this, do I? And then the more we practice that, the more we can generalize and say, oh, that's not as frightening as I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. And the very last sentence, it says, for if a goal is possible to reach, the means to do so must be possible as well.
Exactly.
And you know, that was something that I was really appreciative when I read this. You know, just that idea that not only are we helping you set a goal, but we're giving you the means to reach it.
Right.
You know, and how often does that happen in life?
Yeah.
That somebody gives you the means to reach the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, but we're giving you that.
Right. I think that's really a good metaphor for an excellent teacher, too, is a good teacher won't do it for you, but he'll say, here's the goal, and here's the tools you need to achieve the goal, and here's how you use the tools. You know, it's kind of like a complete step-by-step, you know. In this case, there's just one step, but
yeah.
So it's very, even simpler. It's like, but yeah, I think that's a mark of a really good teacher is you know, provide, you know, here's the goal, and presumably the student is wanting the goal because they're in the classroom, and that's where I think that second to the last sentence, you know, comes in. It says, before we look at them a little closer, remember that if you think they're impossible, your wanting of the purpose has been shaken.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we're saying, well, the means is too difficult, you know, then the question to ask is, do I really want the peace? Do I really want that state of mind where I'm not ruffled by the seeming circumstances?
And right. Once again, it goes back to the priority. Is
yeah.
this goal a priority or not?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the priority obviously has to do with seeing everyone. Well, not obviously, but the more we look at it, the more. And I think that's where a lot of Ken Wapnick's wonderful material around the all-inclusiveness of forgiveness is so helpful, because it basically says, you know, you may not be able to forgive everyone for everything, you know, just right out of the chute, but if you can start with the things that are easy and work up to, you know, the bigger, for whatever was big for you, issues, that sort of builds a mental muscle, if you will, to develop a habit of noticing when we're allowing specifics to upset us, in this case our special relationships with whatever's in front of our face in any given moment, whether it's a person or a group of people or a, you know, an environment or a situation or a collection of aromas, say.
Yes.
You know, so it's basically saying, I can look at what seems to be outside of myself as a symbolic representation of, again, what's in my unconscious mind that is the cause of my upset, and then being willing to look at it, I can let it go. And that letting it go is the mechanism by which we're no longer haunted by it.
That's right.
That the next paragraph kind of reminded me of those magic eye books, the ones where you have a page with a whole bunch of seemingly random little dots or figures, and sometimes different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you can sort of defocus your eyes to look past
yes.
the page,
uh-huh.
suddenly a three-dimensional scene or object or set of objects will appear.
Right.
And I think that's very analogous to what this next paragraph is doing. It says, it is impossible to see your brother as sinless and yet to look upon him as a body. And in a sense, I think it's not like we don't let the light enter our eyes or our sensory data, you know, whether it's smell, taste, touch, or whatever, or sound. It's basically, it's not saying those don't exist and denying the the raw data. It's just basically saying that ego's interpretation, which is, you know, I and you are bodies, and therefore we're condemned because these are finite mortal vehicles and need machines that, you know, are intrinsically you know, not going to work out well in the long term. You just add a century or two to any one of them, they tend to be pretty dysfunctional, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if we can look at the body as a communication device and see past it by seeing the purpose for it as either one of inclusion or exclusion, that can be really helpful, I think, to say, okay, what if I'm seeing you or anyone else as being limited to a specific, which in this case that's the ego's poster child is the body, then we're saying to ourselves, then I am, because I think you are, less than spirit in that view, less than all of spirit, less than perfect oneness. And if we're less than perfect oneness, then we're not whole, and there's an impurity in perfection in that view, which is what we're so used to that we don't even think about it. You know, like we're fish swimming in the ocean, asking, you know, someone says, "Well, what about this water?" And then the fish say, "What water?"
Right, exactly.
we're so totally ingrained in things being partial and special and incomplete and impure because they're not completely everything. It's almost a foreign concept to our everyday minds anyway, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I loved the analogy of, I don't remember what you called a magic eye or the 3D pictures, because isn't that a perfect example of something is embedded there?
Right.
But you have to change your way of looking in order to see it.
Bingo.
You have to change your perspective or you will not see it.
Right.
But it's easy to change your perspective once you know how to do it.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like the first time somebody's describing it to you and you're like, what? But once you've done it and you know what it feels like, you can do it.
Right. Right. And there's also another metaphor that comes in there. Those magic eye books, which by the way, are, I think the technical term for the images are called stereograms, where it relies on the fact that, you know, you're using two eyes to see and basically infer a dimension that isn't there, which is not interesting symbolism. But we have to be willing to look beyond our normal way of looking. And that willingness is before we have that willingness, it's very frustrating. And we don't see the image and we say, well, what's going on? You know, everybody else is passing this book around and sees this 3D thing, and I'm not seeing it yet. And I don't know if you've ever had that experience with those. But then when finally someone gets it, usually there's this shout through the room, "Oh, I finally got it! Now I can see it!"
Right.
And I think that's the kind of elation that we can have. That's not just a temporary. When we finally get that, there really is a way of looking at the world where we see everyone as our savior, see everyone as being giving us not just a piece of the puzzle, but the entire puzzle all at once, moment to moment, and that we have an opportunity to see the perfection in ourselves by seeing it in everyone else. I'm gonna skip ahead.
Okay, just
because I think it fits in perfectly with what we're talking about right now, to the last paragraph. Maybe we can fill in whatever we have time with. But I'm going to do the spoiler alert here on the last paragraph.
Okay.
So the last one says, "Your question should not be, how can I see my brother without the body? Ask only, do I really wish to see him sinless? And as you ask, forget not that his sinlessness is your escape from fear." To me, I think that's the most important sentence in this whole section.
Mm-hmm.
And because it really is basically saying that if I'm willing to look at everyone in my life as the exact perfect mirror of my unconscious mind, and therefore my perfect forgiveness classroom for even the most minor annoyance or irritation, or, you know, on the other end of the extreme, if we think that whoever we're looking at or contemplating, if it's somebody on the news or on your computer screen or whatever, you know, if we think they're, you know, the devil incarnate, you know, or anywhere in between, doesn't matter. As long as there's any discomfort whatsoever, we're saying essentially to ourselves, in that view, I'm choosing my hell. I'm choosing to maintain my hellish mental state by excluding that person or persons from that embrace of perfect oneness. And that's a tough thing to do, you know, but it's really the curriculum here. It's really the whole course of study is to say, can I look at the people in my lives and realize not only are they helpful, they are me. They are and how could you attack yourself, you know, in that awareness? That it just kind of becomes insane, doesn't it? I mean, if we realize that, you know, and that's usually a pretty sporadic and rare thing to see that not only just the sameness but the oneness. And I think that's why the goal of the course really is really not to, you know, it's not as Ken Wapnick says, it's not a course in love, it's a course in miracles, because the miracle is removing the barriers, the obstacles we've placed to love. And because there's really no, in terms of the way that the course described, there's no love in the world, especially if there's no world.
Right.
but the awareness that we can have that allows us to undo the barriers is very doable, and it's moment to moment and cumulative as well. It's basically we get the relief of the strain of constant judgment if we can release that and say, oh yeah, this condemnation, this judgment, this criticism is not working for me. And if I accept the means of looking at that and questioning the value I've put on those judgments, then I can be freed. And that, wow, that's pretty darn cool. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking one of my very favorite lessons is give me your blessing, Holy Son of God.
Yes.
And I will admit, I think the first time I ever heard that lesson, I kind of took it as a mantra. And there were times when somebody, I was getting so angry, I mean, I kind of said it as a curse, you know, give me your blessing, Holy Son of God. You know, I was kind of thinking that under my breath. But it is one of my favorite lessons because it is such a reminder of maybe a couple things. One, we don't go to heaven alone.
Right, right.
You know, this is an all or nothing kind of package. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is it kind of reinforces what this particular passage in the text is talking about. That, and I like that idea of switching from not how do I see him without a body, but how do I see him as sinless?
Yes.
And that becomes my escape from fear. And so when I say that, give me your blessing, Holy Son of God, just the remembrance that there is another way to look at this. There's another way to look at this person. But this person literally holds the key to my escape or the key to my happiness.
Yes. Exactly.
And what a concept.
Yeah.
A concept that every single person holds the key for you.
Right. And I think where we get afraid is I think intuitively we recognize that that's the only approach that will ever work. And that then harkens back to, you know, your wanting of the purpose has been shaken. So because maybe, you know, just maybe we're still a little bit attached to the mileage that we get out of our misery. Mm-hmm. Out of the victimhood, he's just like, "Well, gee, then what story am I going to tell if I'm not suffering?" You know,
right? Exactly.
what kind of party conversation is that going to be? You know, but and I like how you expressed the, you know, give me your blessing with a growl, because I think that's that was wonderful. No, really, because that's really, if we're honest with ourselves, how we look at most situations in the world, and maybe not, you know, using those terms, but with that kind of quality of feeling. When we're annoyed or irritated or upset with anyone or anything in any way, and being willing to look at it is really the substance of the course. It's not about, you know, affirmations. It's not about saying, you know, you're my savior, and the sense that you know, we just jump in and immediately go to that state in our mind. No, we have to actually drag our resistance onto the altar of the mind and you know, sometimes kicking and screaming, But we're the one that has to expend the effort, not our inner kindness teacher. They're the coach. They're the one that's the cheerleader that says, yeah, you can do this. I know you can do this. You know, we know it's doable because you're already home and you're just dreaming in exile. But yeah, I think the growl that you used to express that mantra, it was perfect, because that's basically what we need to look at. Why do we have that growl, and how much mileage do we think we're getting from it?
Yeah, but I mean, partially it's because it goes back to in my mind, the gap between what intellectually I believe to be true and experientially what I believe to be true.
Right.
So when I read that, and when I read that lesson, I'm like, that is absolutely true. I know it in my heart. I know this is true. But to experience it as true is something else.
Right, right.
You know, and so that's it. It's like, he's got the key to my happiness. Are you sure? You know, are you sure about that? And so that is how I felt. But like I said, I kind of even laughed at myself, because I tried for days to just keep that on my lips, you know, to remember every single person. Give me your blessing, Holy Son of God.
Yes.
You know,
yes. And that's the key. I'm glad you said the word key, because it reminded me of a Sufi story that I actually used in the workshop that I did last weekend. And at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center, and I read this. I'm going to paraphrase it because it's you know, a little longer. But the gist of it is, there's this fellow named Mullah Nasruddin, and he's out on the street one evening, and he's under the street lamp, and his friend happens along and says, "Hey, what you doing?" He says, "Oh, I'm looking for the key to my house." And he's on, you know, hands and knees, and pretty, you know, after a few minutes, his friend's down there, and it's his hands and knees too, helping him look for the key. And, you know, they're kind of looking around, and you know, a little time passes, and finally, the friend says, "So, where'd you lose the key?" After, you know, he says, "Oh, I lost it in my house." And then his friend's, "Well, what the hell are you?" Well, I don't know. What are you looking for it out here for? And I added the pejorative term, but he says, "Well, there's more," you know, Mula says, "there's more light out here." But
well,
that's
of course,
it's
hysterical, but how often do we do that?
Exactly. And I think that's the timelessness of that wonderful little story is and the humor, the joke's on us, that whenever we, you know, go along with ego's nonsense of saying, "Well, I, as long as I find it outside, you know, myself, then I'm off the hook. As long as my happiness or my peace of mind is dependent or contingent on something that's outside the domain of my, you know, my jurisdiction, which is the mind, then I can forever justify my martyrdom. I can forever stay a victim and say, oh, well, it's not my fault, you know, the world's doing this to me, or these people are doing this to me." And so I think, you know, ego secretly likes it, because that's part of its shields of oblivion of, you know, don't blow my cover.
Right.
Don't blow my cover, or I'm going to be forced to be peaceful consistently, and I can't stand that. You know, that's, I mean, this is crazy, but that's kind of the bottom line of the ego's story, you know, thinking that somehow by giving up the misery, we're going to be miserable.
Right. Well, you know, that's a very good point. In fact, I was kind of coming along with you thinking that it really does go back to, and I mean, I certainly knew, you know, I felt this many times when I was reading the course text the first time around is, oh, well, perfect happiness or perfect peace, that sounds kind of boring. And we're not sure that we do want that reward. I can still honestly say that. Right. Maybe I don't want perfect peace because I can't imagine what that feels like. And within the context of my life, it sounds a little boring.
Well, I think,
you know?
Yeah, I hear you. And I think why we have that, I think it's part of the ego's elaborate defensive strategy. And I think, again, what we think of as peace as egos is really more of a euphoric, very fleeting, temporary thing. I don't think we have the foggiest idea about what real peace is or what real love is, as the Course would describe either of those terms. And I think for that reason, we're comparing illusion A to illusion B instead of comparing truth to illusion. And the illusion A equals illusion B equals illusion C is something ego never wants us to look at, because if we do that, then we'll say, well, then what else is there? And then immediately from the dim archives of the back of our minds, this little quiet voice says, oh, yeah, there's this piece that doesn't change, that is on a vertical axis metaphorically, that's the truth of what we are, that we just get glimpses of. And I think a very typical reaction is to have an emotional or a quick experience, and then we kind of back away from it, because I think the quality of that is so overwhelming and it's so powerful that if we were to sustain it for very long, and the course alludes to this, it basically says, we don't want to deprive you of the little you think you have. And the reason I think for that is because if we were to, pull off the blinders that we put on ourselves, all of a sudden we would retreat more deeply into fear. We would freak out because it would be so foreign to us. So we have to wean ourselves from the darkness just a little at a time and develop a comfort to where we can say, yeah, I can sustain this level of peace for a little bit longer. And even that is I think just a drop of a shadow of a reflection of the peace that is really, in store for
us. Is possible.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Very, very good point that there just isn't anything, just like there is no love in our lives or on this planet. There's no way for us to really know what that peace feels like.
Exactly.
So what we most often do is probably like me. I kind of look at where I am though and go, okay, well, this can't be it.
Right.
I don't like this. So I'm moving away from, what do they call it? The stick or the carrot?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
More often than not, I'm probably trying to avoid the stick.
And of course, the ego's strategy is seek but do not find. So it's always the carrot on the stick. So no matter how close we get, it's always a few feet away.
Right. So, well, I want to ask you, what brought this up? Why did you want to talk about this?
Actually, I was just kind of flipping through the book at random, and I put quotes over the word random, and this just kind of grabbed me, because I think it's a kind of a down in the trenches part of the text, where it basically, hits us right between the eyes of, what is my purpose? What is my purpose for anything? What's the intention of any observation that I make, and is it one of separate interest or shared interest? Is it one of I could see peace instead of this, or I'd rather see the this?
Right.
and that's okay if we're honest with ourselves. I think that honesty goes a long way, because it helps us use this law of contrast that the course advocates as a huge part of our classroom, to really point out how abysmally unfulfilling our ego's agenda is, and just to have us watch it. And another metaphor that I probably used before that is a favorite one is like not just draining a swamp, it's like draining the oceans on a planetary, a desolate planet. And, we from a distance, some of those islands look like little paradises, but then when we get there, it's like, well, it's mostly just a lot of dry sand and there might be a palm tree here and there, but then when we start looking at the ego's shenanigans and it's desolate and despicable, mm-hmm. a view of everything and everyone and how unfulfilling that is. But without judgment, without condemnation, if we can just slowly but surely drain, the ocean of ego's thought system, eventually we're going to see, yeah, there's nothing really there for me. But it doesn't mean that we leave physically necessarily, but we leave mentally from the ego's thought system.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're just walking around on the desert planet and saying, yeah, but that's not my real self. My real self is this incredibly infinite oasis that we all share that could never be touched by anything involving space and time. And that's our real identity, that's outside the dream of space-time and completely at peace and completely free, and that we get these little glimpses of now and then.
Right.
By practicing the forgiveness, which is the means that this section addresses.
Yes. Well, I think this has been a great discussion.
Me too.
And I really thank you for randomly
coming
across this. No, I thought the timing of it was perfect. Like I said, when you first suggested, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to study up on this and remember what it means. But the timing was perfect, really.
Yeah, I think so for me too. I mean, and that's again the reason why, you know, at the beginning you said something about the fear, and that's why I keep coming back to this beloved blue book that my ego hates so much. It is to remind myself that that's really what I do want. That the end really is that important and that profound and that wonderful, and to remind myself that I'm clueless. I as a separate self am clueless. But there's something in me that knows there must be a better way, and that if I'm consistent with the means and end, and I can, you know, eventually let go of my addiction to the sin, guilt, and fear paradigm, and just say, that's not working for me, and leave the desert altogether.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, CA.
And do you have any announcements that you'd like to make before we close the show today?
Oh, I do, actually. There is a virtual conference, an ACIM virtual conference that's happening in October, and there's a number of people, several dozen people. If you go to miracleshare.org, you'll see that. I've also got links to it on acimblog.com, and basically what it is a three-day conference that's held online, so there's no travel, hotels, gas, rental cars, any of that kind of stuff. And I participated last year, and it was a blast. I totally enjoyed it. And the format is basically each of the presenters has a pre-recorded video that's either a monologue or a conversation with the conference organizers for half an hour. And then the next half hour is a live Q&A that's audio only with everybody in the conference. And it's great fun, and I got a whole lot out of all the other presenters. I listened to them all as the 3 days was progressing. And there's also a little chat window, and I had some fun chatting with people who you know, if it wasn't their turn for the microphone or whatever at the moment. There was a lot of great conversation in the chat as well. So I highly recommend it. It's you just go to miracleshare.org and click on the conference there. Or if you want to go to ACIM blog, I've got a little write-up on it with a link to all the presenters' websites on my most recent blog post. And you'll see a little graphic of it just at acimblog.com.
Oh, great. And I think that sounds wonderful.
It will be. It's October 16th and 17th and 18th. And also, I've just got one. It's not really completely formulated yet, but Barrett Hedin and Lynn Johnson are two people that I know of that are participating in organizing an ACIM conference in Estes Park next June. And Gary Renard and Cindy Laura Renard will be there, and several other people that are course folk, and probably a whole lot of people will be interested. But that's about as much as I know, other than the June timeframe, and Estes Park is the place. So
is it going to be at the Stanley Hotel?
I think it might be, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
The Shining Hotel. This is scary stuff, folks.
Well, it is, but we have a guide that can take us through it and guide us to the end through the means.
Yes, that's right. Good way to end the show today, Bruce.
Thanks, CA.
Hey, well, thank you so much. I have really appreciated this, and I look forward to talking to you again next month.
Likewise.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Well, that's a wrap for today. Thanks for making A Course in Miracles part of your day. And thanks to the listeners and to everybody in the chat room who participated that way. And a special thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. You can find me for personal readings, consultations, mentoring, and coaching on 12listen.com. And you can also find me on Tuesdays for my show, Simple Tales, where we discuss one of my very favorite illusions. We talk about astrology and tarot and a number of other things. I'm live every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 Eastern. You have about 5 minutes until our next show, The Through Line with Christine DeMaurier, coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 12 Radio. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and with my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 12 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.